From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US president describes the Islamic State ideology as a cancer and once again calls for an international force to come together to dismantle and destroy the jihadist movement.
The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force. So the United States of America will work with a broad coalition to dismantle this network of death.
Also today, we look at how computer games are aiding breakthroughs in medical science. And out of this world, India celebrates its successful mission to the Mars orbit.
History has been created today. We have dared to reach out into the unknown and have achieved the near impossible.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. A French tourist who was kidnapped by an Algerian militant group has allegedly been beheaded by his captors. A new video claims to show 55-year-old Irv Goudel being killed after the group issued a 24-hour ultimatum for the French government to stop airstrikes in Iraq. The Algerian militants, known as Jund al-Khalifa, have recently pledged allegiance to the ISIS group in Syria and Iraq, responding to calls for Western civilians to be targeted. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman says the killing of Mr. Goudel is unlikely to change France's actions in the region.
The French government said very clearly when the first video of Mr. Goudel emerged on Tuesday that it would do everything it could to bring him back. And there are reports that some special units were attempting his rescue in Algeria. But French President François Hollande did very publicly reject the possibility to negotiate for his life. Now, this latest video released by the Algerian militants, titled Message of Blood for the French Government, is clearly designed to blame France for his beheading, which they will of course reject, and make the case for the need to continue going after ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
This comes as U.S. President Barack Obama has warned the world about the cancer of violent extremism in a speech to the United Nations General Assembly. He's trying to build support against the Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. Our correspondent at the UN, Nick Harper, says the speech touched on many topics.
This was President Obama's warning for the future. Going into it, we heard this was going to be a forceful and optimistic message, certainly forceful, but perhaps light on the optimism. He talked about the dangers and the unease, saying the world was at a crossroads between war and peace. ISIS, the threat of the Islamic State, dominated much of the speech, and he called on all countries to help America in the fight against extremism.
Meanwhile, the UK's Parliament is being recalled to discuss taking part in military action against Islamic State militants. MPs will debate the matter on Friday, leading to possible UK airstrikes as early as the weekend. Natalie Feary reports from London.
Prime Minister David Cameron says UK MPs will debate responding to the Iraqi government's request for assistance. This Iraqi request, the UK believes, gives it the legal cover for intervention on foreign soil. Mr. Cameron is confident MPs will back airstrikes on Islamic State militants in Iraq. But UK military action is not likely to take place inside Syria. It was only just over a year ago the Commons was recalled and voted against intervention in Syria. The UK is already providing arms and assistance to Kurdish forces fighting Islamic State militants.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. NATO says it has seen a significant withdrawal of Russian forces from eastern Ukraine, but says that some forces still remain there. It comes after a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine and the withdrawal of Ukrainian forces from the area. Tom Barton reports from Moscow.
Lieutenant Colonel Jay Jansen says that because pro-Russian militants control a number of border crossings into eastern Ukraine, it is difficult to tell how many Russian troops are in the country. Moscow still denies sending troops into eastern Ukraine or arming the pro-Russian rebels. A shaky ceasefire has seen reported violations, but has held since the 5th of September. Russian forces annexed Crimea in March, which brought international condemnation and sanctions against Moscow. Fighting then spread to the east of Ukraine, stoked by Russia, says Kiev, that the UN says has claimed 3,245 lives since April.
and biosafety experts in the U.S. are warning that American hospitals may be unprepared to safely get rid of the infectious waste generated by any Ebola patients in the country. Waste management companies are refusing to deal with any gear associated with treating the disease, as Lerna Shattuck reports.
The issue over Ebola waste has come to light after Emory Hospital in Atlanta treated two U.S. missionaries for the disease this summer. Bags of waste began to pile up as the hospital's waste contractor, Stericycle, refused to handle them. The company said that federal guidelines require Ebola-related waste, such as soiled sheets or protective gear, to be handled in special packaging by people with hazardous materials training. Emory had to keep the bags in a special containment area for 6 days until the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention helped broker an agreement with Stericycle. Biosafety experts say it's only a matter of time before more Ebola-infected patients are diagnosed in America. They warn that many U.S. hospitals are unaware of the federal waste disposal guidelines and few would have the ability to deal with Ebola-related waste.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
No God condones this terror. No grievance justifies these actions. There can be no reasoning, no negotiation with this brand of evil. The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force. So the United States of America will work with a broad coalition to dismantle this network of death.
President Obama addressing the UN General Assembly, citing growing anxiety over new dangers, including the rise of ISIS, Russian aggression in Ukraine, and the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. Mr. Obama did cut away from the pessimism momentarily to describe this as the best time in human history to be born. However, the majority of his message was aimed at the Islamic State militant threat in Syria and Iraq, calling the group's ideology a cancer, and once again calling on international forces to come together to dismantle and destroy the jihadist movement. Li Ling Tan is at the UN headquarters in New York.
The president spent half of his 35-minute speech addressing the growing threat from the militant group. He talked about their brutal tactics in terrorizing people across Iraq and Syria, the dumping of bodies in mass graves, starving of religious minorities to death, gunning down children, and using sexual violence as a weapon of war. And he also talked about the beheadings and the sharing of these beheading videos with the world. Now, Obama also talked about the U.S.-led campaign to deal with ISIL and associated terrorist groups, saying the international community must meet the challenge in four key areas. The first one was to degrade and destroy the terrorist group.
Already over 40 nations have offered to join this coalition. Today I ask the world to join in this effort. Those who have joined ISIL should leave the battlefield while they can. Those who continue to fight for a hateful cause will find they are increasingly alone.
The second area of focus is on galvanizing the world and especially Muslim communities to reject the ideology of Al-Qaeda and ISIL, including zero tolerance of clerics who call on people to harm innocents, be they Jewish, Christians or Muslims, to stop the corruption of young minds with violent ideology and to cut off funding that fuels this type of hate. Now, that extraordinary Security Council meeting will help move the international community in that direction with the adoption of a resolution compelling countries to take actions, including criminalizing the financing of terrorism and recruiting of terrorists. This is also an extraordinary session as it will make more apparent the consensus the international community is having over this threat compared with the deep divisions we're seeing elsewhere in other crises.
Li Ling, speaking of other crises, what did the US president say about the Ukrainian situation?
The president did give a scathing account of what he termed was Russia's territorial ambition, saying that Russia's actions in Ukraine challenges a post-war order in which the United Nations was formed to ensure no nation can subjugate its neighbors and claim their territory.
We believe that right makes might, that bigger nations should not be able to bully smaller ones, and that people should be able to choose their own future. And these are simple truths, but they must be defended.
while making clear his criticism of Russia's actions and promising to impose a cost on Russia's aggression, the portion of the president's speech on the Ukraine conflict was considerably brief in comparison to the terrorist segment, and little details were provided. Obama only touched very briefly on Ebola, saying that the U.S. is deploying doctors and scientists, but a broader effort is needed to pursue treatments, and the U.S. will continue mobilizing other countries to further fight the epidemic. In fact, apart from ISIL, Obama only touched on the other crises, devoting perhaps a paragraph or two on Ebola, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, poverty, and climate change. But overall, really, this was a speech to mobilize rather than to inform.
FSN's Li Ling Tan in New York. The expansion of US-led airstrikes has continued, with IS militants targeted in both Iraq and Syria. Some reports say air assaults had hit sites near the Turkish border, where over 100,000 refugees have fled Syria as IS fighters advance through the region. Laura Wells is a freelance journalist in Istanbul, Turkey.
Well, certainly the coalition led by the United States against the Islamic State continues. They are bombing different coordinates of Islamic State headquarters and fighters, as well as al-Nusra, which they also call Khorasan. The continued influx of refugees from the Kobane area on the Turkish border continues. This is still an area where Islamic State is fighting Kurdish fighters in this predominantly Kurdish area. Some estimates are 150,000 to 200,000 refugees, though some activists, Kurdish activists, and even someone I know that is on the border right now, disputes these numbers. They think it's much lower, perhaps anywhere from 20 to 60,000, although we cannot confirm. This is a pretty hectic situation. These are Syrian Kurdish people that are fleeing on foot. And certainly the Turkish government has been allowing them to come into Turkey since Friday when the situation became critical. Turkey has opened and closed the borders several times since Friday when the Syrian Kurdish refugees first started coming. They had been waiting there for many days since the Islamic State had surrounded the Kurdish area and the town of Kobane. We've heard that the Kurdish fighters are doing a fairly good job at keeping Islamic State away from Kobane. But the Syrian Kurds are pounding the table, asking the international coalition to bomb the Islamic State in that area. So far, that has not happened. It has happened in many different places all over Syria, but it has not happened in that specific area where the Islamic State is surrounding the Kurds. They're pinning them against the Turkish border, and it continues to be a flashpoint.
And Laura, what are you hearing now about where the Turkish leadership position on this anti-ISIS coalition? Are we getting close to a point where Turkey is going to commit, especially following the release of those 49 Turkish hostages from IS control and, of course, the most recent series of airstrikes from the US-led coalition?
President Erdogan is in New York City now, and he said that he doesn't think the coalition against the Islamic State and the airstrikes will be effective unless they have a greater and more comprehensive plan to eradicate the extremism in the area. Turkish authorities have blamed this extremism and the Islamic State on Sunni discontent in both Iraq and in Syria. In Iraq, they blame the weak, corrupt, and Shiite-dominated government. In Syria, they blame Assad for disenfranchising his own people and his unspeakable acts against many, the bulk of which are in Sunni areas. Those were the ones that first started protesting against Assad. So I think unless this coalition has greater plans to help those which are feeling disenfranchised and which are drawn to some Sunni empowerment, I don't think you'll see Turkey coming in. I know that Turkey also wants to have a greater hand in the region. They would like to help build the Iraqi government to be more inclusive, including those Sunnis. And certainly, I think that is non-negotiable. They want to see Assad gone. Unless these are met, I don't consider Turkey joining this coalition anytime soon.
Another interpretation of Erdogan's hesitation to commit to this anti-ISIS coalition. One theory it does surround the release of those dozens of those Turkish diplomats from IS control, and that perhaps a deal was done. Do you have any information on that?
President Erdogan has been having many speaking engagements in New York around the UN meeting. Many people have asked him if Turkey had swapped some Islamic State prisoners for the 49 hostages. He has not answered this clearly. Mm. What he said was this was a feat of diplomacy, and he said whether there was a swap or not, the most important thing was that Turkish citizens were back at home safely. One pro-government newspaper has said that there was a swap. That has not been disputed by the ruling party's supporters. So I think there probably was some sort of prisoner swap for the hostages.
Freelance Turkey correspondent Laura Wells. The UK Prime Minister David Cameron is also at the UN in New York and is coming under increasing pressure for the Royal Air Force to play a direct role in the battle against the Islamic State fighters, joining the coalition of Western and Arab nations. LBC's Lisa Aziz spoke to Lord David Hannay, the ambassador to the UN during the first Gulf War, and began by asking Mr. Hannay if the UK leader will bend to the pressure.
Well, I think the case for joining this coalition, which is not just a Western coalition but involves most of the main Arab countries of the region, is a very compelling one.
If we talk about also where it leaves President Assad, some papers calling it an unholy alliance. I mean, the irony surely not lost on anyone just now that we potentially could be joining that Arab alliance in doing his dirty work.
Well, I don't think I would look at it that way. No effort is being made to coordinate the work of this coalition with President Assad, who is a man who has committed terrible crimes against his own people. But the fact is that these insurgents, ISIL, have attacked another sovereign state of the United Nations, Iraq, and are committing appalling crimes, which are totally contrary to everything we've all signed up to in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights.
Lord Hannay, the current alliance, the Arab alliance, helping the US now, is it significant that those countries have the Sunni majority?
Well, I think that shows that they've understood that these people are genuinely ISIL, are really outlaws. It's irrelevant that they say that they are Sunni. There is no religious authority anywhere in the world, as far as I can see, that believes that they are acting in a manner consistent with Islamic teaching. So this is a self-promoting label they've put on themselves, but not one that's accepted by their own co-religionists.
Fair to say what's going on now is very different to the first Gulf War in a number of ways.
Yes, it is, but there is some caution required too. It is really important that this doesn't come to look like an attack by the West with the objective of occupying an Arab country, whether that be Iraq or Syria. It must not either be that or look like that.
Lord Hannay, I can't let you go without asking you about news today, of course, that the wife of the British aid volunteer, Alan Henning, threatened with death by IS militants. She's received an audio recording of her husband. What can we assume is going on in the background? Because Philip Hammond, we know, has said that we're getting warm to finding the so-called jihadi John.
Well, I think it's an agonising situation, and one can only have the greatest sympathy with anyone of his family. But the way these people are manipulating hostages, people they've taken who've gone to Syria to help ordinary Syrian people, is quite appalling. I've no idea what's going on. I'm sure an attempt is being made to get messages through to them that they will do nothing but damage to themselves if they harm this man.
Lord David Hannay, the ambassador to the UN during the first Gulf War, on LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. India has become the first Asian nation to reach Mars, with the country's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, leading the congratulations.
History has been created today. We have dared to reach out into the unknown and have achieved the near impossible. I congratulate all ISRO scientists as well as all my fellow Indians on this historic occasion.
India is the first nation on any continent to reach Mars on its first attempt. The world's most populous democracy joins the US, Russia and Europe in successful Mars flights. India launched the $70 million Mars spacecraft last November. Journalist Rahul Bedi is in Mumbai.
It's a historic moment for India. In fact, it's joined a very elite club, which includes Europe, Russia and the US. And what makes it a lot more pleasanter and sweeter for India is that it's made an attempt. And whilst there have been several other attempts by many countries, very few countries have succeeded on their first go. So that makes India, in fact, doubly proud.
Mm. And well, let's talk money, because just 48 hours before India's historic moment, NASA's MAVEN mission made it to Mars. That cost $670 million. How much did India's project come in at?
Well, the estimates are about $74 million. And in fact, it's a joke doing the rounds that $74 million is less than some of the amounts spent on science fiction Hollywood blockbusters like Gravity, for example, which had a budget of about $100 million. So this has come in under $75 million. And it's a very cheap bang for the buck.
Why is that? How have they managed to keep the budget so low?
Well, it's much, much cheaper in India. I'm not an expert on the vehicle that's gone up, but I assume that given the atmosphere and the technology that exists in India, there's a lot of innovation that has happened. Mm-hmm. And because there's not much money around and there's a limited amount of technology, I think people have to make do and make revolutionary changes. So I think all that put together has led to this costing a fraction of what the Americans have paid.
But it's important to say that while the $70 million is a fraction of what NASA threw at their project, India is still a country that is struggling with poverty and hunger. While the Prime Minister is happy about today's achievement, can the same be said of the people who voted him into power?
Well, the Prime Minister is very euphoric about it, and the Prime Minister is a very good speaker, and he rabble-roused a lot of the scientists, and he was on television in the morning when the news came in, and he put up a very good performance. But the average man on the street doesn't really know what a mission to Mars really means. And whilst this has been criticized quite heavily, that India, being a poor country, cannot be so extravagant to send a mission to Mars, the other side of the argument is that science is something that has infinite possibilities, and it can be exploited to developing countries as well as bring in and alleviate poverty by its application. So it's mm-hmm. it's a double-edged sword, mm-hmm. Considering the costs are so low, I think it's an option worth taking.
It's undeniable that this has been a great PR moment for India's advancements in technology and in space exploration. But do you think, is there a sense in the country that this will somehow translate financially, that money eventually could be made from this?
It's quite possible that some of the technologies that have been used in this can be applied. Innumerable technologies that go into developing such a thing, and a lot of them have applications in the civilian field, in the medical field, in the industrial field. And it's quite possible that there will be a spin-off. It really remains to be seen whether India can exploit these technologies to these ends. I mean, India needs about a third of India's population of 1.25 billion live below the poverty line, earning less than a dollar a day, and they desperately need to be uplifted. So some of these technologies could help them, for example, in telecommunication, in medicine. So it's quite possible that these can be applied over the next few years and can pay back the amount that's been invested in them.
Journalist Rahul Bedi in Mumbai. Now, when Facebook acquired the virtual reality hardware developer Oculus VR in March for $2 billion, CEO Mark Zuckerberg hailed the firm's technology as a new communication platform. Even though it's not yet clear how Facebook will marry social media with a 3D gaming experience, its high-profile purchase catapulted Oculus's virtual reality headset, the Oculus Rift, into the limelight. More and more developers are enabling their games with Oculus Rift support, or creating games specifically for the device. Its potential applications reach far beyond the realms of pure entertainment, even into medicine. Rebecca Bowring has more.
After the workday is done, virtual reality enthusiasts meet in a San Francisco office space to play. They're trying out the latest immersive 3D experiences for the Oculus Rift. Many games are still in their alpha phase because the headset is so new, only available as a development kit and not yet for consumers. Adam Bruce is a partner at the event's host, the VR Lab. He says Facebook's acquisition of Oculus will secure virtual reality's place in the mainstream.
When they were purchased by Facebook, it's probably when the development community really stood up and took note. A lot of investments started coming into the sector. A lot of new Kickstarter projects have embraced Oculus as a way of having deep immersion. Perhaps the bigger windfall reaction is when Google entered the market with the Cardboard VR.
Cardboard VR is an inexpensive, do-it-yourself virtual reality kit. San Francisco-based Dodo Case has also brought out a viewer. Placing special lenses over a smartphone and loading an app that displays 3D images creates a virtual reality experience on the go. Craig Dalton is CEO and co-founder of Dodo Case.
It really is bringing virtual reality to the masses. It's a very accessible price point. It's going to be a way for people to have that first taste of virtual reality before they look at purchasing more elaborate systems.
One of the areas virtual reality could profoundly impact is healthcare. James Blaha and Manish Gupta have created a VR video game to help treat lazy eye, where the brain favors one eye, leading to a loss of vision and depth perception. Diplopia is an asteroid-busting space game. It shows a different image and brightness to each eye. Only the weak one can see rings, while the strong one can see the spaceship, so a player must work both eyes in tandem to succeed. Here's James Blaha.
With the Oculus Rift, we can control every aspect of the image that's being sent to each eye. We can make it full 3D, immersive 3D, so with the head tracking, you can look all over the place.
Diplopia is receiving interest from potential subjects for an academic trial. Blaha was himself born with lazy eye.
After about 20 hours of gameplay spread out over 5 weeks, I went from having no 3D vision at all to having almost normal 3D vision.
Of course, the Oculus Rift isn't the only headset on the scene. Sony is working on its own, called Project Morpheus. Virtual reality may not have fully caught on, but it promises a future that's out of this world. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, email us reports@featurestory.com. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.